Hello, my friends, and welcome to our show. It's called Stand to Reason. I'm your host, Greg Kokol. Glad to have you with me, and look forward to the next, actually 2 hours, because I'm doing these two shows here, interacting with you. If you'd like to call the show, you're welcome to do so. If you're listening live streaming, you can call right now. Or if you're not, then you can call during the time when we are on live, and that is Tuesday from 4 until 6 p.m. L.A. times. The number, 855-243-9975. That's 855-243-9975. And I am I'm a little bit nostalgic right now because of something that happened this last weekend. I'll tell you about in just a moment. But before I get to that, I just want to bring up that for those of you interested in the Seattle reality coming up, just a little bit more than a week from now. In fact, you'll be hearing this broadcast, if you get it right away, on Wednesday, and that would be a week from Friday then. In Seattle, October 15th through 16th, we have our second of our series of six reality conferences around the country. They can hold 1215 there. That's maximum capacity. And right now we got 1126. I mean, that's almost full. We're almost sold out. So when you hear this, that's 89 tickets left, and you're thinking about attending the Seattle event, strike the iron quickly. Go to realityapologetics.com, or is it .org? No, .com. Here it is. realityapologetics.com, and check out the Seattle one and sign up quickly. Now, if you want to go to Minneapolis, we still got room because we're pushing around 2,000, 1,863 right now. I think they can hold 4,000. So we got room there, but we still got 6 weeks or 7 weeks to go before that event. And we're thrilled to see so many people signed up so soon and so early. That may get sold out too. I think we're going to hit 3,000. We have never hit 3,000 before at an event, but I don't see any reason why we're not going to hit that in Minneapolis on November 12th and 13th. So just saying about that. Now, I mentioned that I had been feeling a little bit nostalgic. I've been a Christian 48 years. In fact, 48 years ago, 1 week from one week ago today. And I became a Christian during the Jesus Movement. And I attended within, I'm just thinking, about 2 months after I became, February, January, about 4 months. 4 months after I became a Christian. So February 1974, I moved into a Christian community called the Jesus Christ Light and Power House in Westwood Village at an old fraternity house and right on the edge of UCLA campus. And this is where I got my foundation in Christianity, this wonderful place that was very unusual, very unique, very Jesus freakish. But that's where I met Craig Englert and his wife, Kathy, and Craig took me under his wing, and she did as well. It was a package deal. I got them, they got me. And for 2.5 years, really, functionally, we were in this deep relationship, and then our paths took us a little further away. I got out of that school, and I went to college to finish up my undergraduate work, but I ended up getting connected with the church that they got connected with, which is where Craig was now a staff pastor. That church actually was a church that I began attending while I was still at the Light and Power House, while Craig was attending there, and the church was Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. It was started in 1971 by Ralph Moore, just a young guy out of Bible college, and his wife, Ruby. And his idea was that he just wanted to have a place where a bunch of surfers in the South Bay in Hermosa Beach could come and learn about Jesus and find out about forgiveness. And it was kind of the wave of the time, this whole new counterculture Christianity thing that later became known as the Jesus Movement. And Ralph was a player there. And he opened his church. It was a small little church on Manhattan Beach Boulevard there in Manhattan Beach at that point. And Hope Chapel. And they, I remember my first teaching there, sitting on the floor of that church with a Bible in my lap, teaching a group of people. I mean, I couldn't have been more than a couple of years old in the Lord, but that was my first real church. And Ralph Moore was my first pastor. And after the Light and Powerhouse era, then I was, that's when Craig Englert became a pastor there. And then I became a regular goer. I even led worship at Hope Chapel. I mean, this is crazy. I'm not a worship leader, but I led worship there, you know. And I would, honestly, just thinking of this now, Doris, who played the piano on the stage leading worship, I would be up there, you know, and I couldn't remember the words to the song, you know, and she'd be hovering over the keys while I was trying to figure out the words, and it was crazy. But there's a reason that I'm mentioning this to you about Hope Chapel, because this, and even my lame efforts of being involved there in different types of ministry, because this last weekend was the 50-year anniversary of the founding of Hope Chapel, Hermosa Beach. And Ralph Moore, who left Hope Chapel 10 years into it, basically early 80s, and passed the baton over to Zach Nazarian, who was the pastor when I worked at Hope Chapel as a staff pastor for about 8 years, and who sent Stand to Reason out as an organization in 1993. Well, that's the place that I really established my roots as a Christian, all right? So I was trained like at Light and Powerhouse and discipled there with Craig, and then Craig was also part of the staff, so it was a natural move being a part of that organization, that whole local church. The very first time I even taught at that local church, I stood on the stage of an old bowling alley they were converting now, there in the center of Hermosa Beach, into a church, and that was 1976. When I had just returned from my time in Eastern Europe, and I was telling them about my experiences working with Christians behind the Iron Curtain. I go that far back, and that was before I was on staff there. It was another 8 years or so until I became a staff pastor there for a further 8 years, and then I got sent out at Stand to Reason. What was so cool about this last weekend is seeing Craig and Kathy there, and Zach, my pastor and my boss for those years, and Ralph Moore, who had been my first pastor for those first 10 years. I was there 25 years. But the thing that really touched me about Ralph that I remember is that he was a pastor who was willing to give people a chance that wanted to make a difference for Christ, even if they weren't clever, they didn't have education, they didn't have all these other things, but they had a desire to serve the Lord, and they had some capability and some gifting, and he was willing to give some room for that. So here's me, I'm teaching the Bible, sitting on the floor, I got some Bible training, I knew more than the other people I was training, so there I was teaching a Bible study in the church before we moved to the big church, the old bowling alley. There I was leading in the bowling alley. Now we made the move leading worship, and I can't sing the songs. I remember once I led worship, and I kept adding song after song after song. And then I said, okay, one more song, and then Ralph will come up and preach. And Ralph was sitting in the front row, and he said, one more song, and we're going home. Because I had led the worship through the entire service. I wasn't watching the clock. I wasn't paying attention. Now, this is the Jesus movement days, man. The Spirit was flowing, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that was Ralph. God bless his heart. But he gave me a shot. Now, not only gave me a shot, but he gave a lot of people a shot. All right? He wasn't a person to hang on to power. And in fact, 10 years into that enterprise, a very successful church, a Friday night service, a Saturday night service, 3 services Sunday morning. That's a lot of services. That's a lot of people. This was a going concern. He was willing to, as he put it, give up the ring. Going back to Tolkien, just give up the ring and pass it on to Zach so he could go to Oahu and start another church on the windward side there. And that's where he spent most of the rest of his time as a pastor, and not just with that church, but others as well. Now, this idea of giving people a chance to get going, which to me was magnificent, and a lot of pastors would not have the ego strength to allow. Just saying, all right? But this was a strength of Pastor Ralph. And he wasn't what? I'm just thinking he was probably just like a year or two older than me. I mean, we were almost the same age. We were both in our 20s, for goodness sake. But this was just a new era, a new shot, a new deal, and the Holy Spirit was working, and this is what happened under his leadership. But not only was he willing to give people a shot, kind of in a local sense, but he was also willing to give people away. In fact, he was willing to give his own church away, even though it was thriving, to another person. And this is something that got built into my DNA, because one characteristic of Hope Chapel, much like the Calvary Chapels at the same time, was that Hope Chapel would hive off and start other Hope Chapels. And pretty soon in the South Bay, in Hawthorne, and in Marina del Rey, and in other Hope Chapels were popping up in their other communities. In fact, my brother Mark was a pastor of one of those Hope Chapels. All right. And he 30 years later, he's still pastoring there, he's moving towards retirement, but he was just one of those sent out. And so even though they were able to raise up talent within their own environment and train them and nurture them and have that talent, those people who were gifted to make a difference in the local church there, Hope Chapel, Hermosa Beach, Ralph wasn't afraid to say, okay, now get out of here, go start your own church. And when your church is strong and built up in a little bit, go ahead and take some of your people and send out, and they start another church. So there's a multiplication factor that's in play here. And this idea, by the way, the example of Ralph sending out, hiving off, letting go of quality people, and not being afraid to do it, having the vision and the ego strength and the courage to allow that to happen, well, that's what created a kind of, I'm trying to think of the best word, a tsunami of impact over the years. Because as Ralph was talking at the 50th anniversary on Sunday doing the sermon of Hope Chapel, Hermosa Beach, he mentioned, this isn't about Hope Chapel, this is really about Hope Chapels and about what God accomplished. And he is not the kind of person, just not his personality, to kind of follow all of the impact in the churches and all that. Some people who are bean counters, they say, okay, we planted this church, they planted four churches, those four churches planted eight churches, and we got their names. Well, that wasn't Ralph. He was just out there doing the work, making a difference, and letting God cause the increase. And that was a passage that he cited in 1 Corinthians. I planted, Apollos watered. God caused the increase. But there was an occasion, and I'm not sure all the details here, of somebody was doing a survey, doing an analysis, trying to figure out how churches could have the best impact. And what Ralph had done to figure that out is he read the entire book of Acts every single day for months and months and months and months, maybe years. I'm losing track of the details, but it was a long time. Because he wanted to ingrain in his subconscious the early church and the impact of the church and the philosophy of ministry. He just wanted to just absorb it so that whole thing kind of came out of him, and that's what he was doing. But and he was doing it effectively over the years. Somebody noticed that. Let's see how what you were doing really worked and what's the ultimate impact. And he said, I don't know. We don't keep a list of that. Well, can you find out? Well, okay, I'll email a bunch of people I know that are pastors that we've sent out. Well, he sent out a gazillion emails, and a bunch of people got back, and they were able to collate the information. And when they were done collating, it turned out that the number was something like 2,300 local churches over the last 40 years, or 50 years now. I mean, that's a mind-boggling number, but that's not the number. Because what happened is when that number got out, other people that were associated with Hope Chapel started getting back to Ralph and saying, wait a minute, my name is not on that list. And I was a church that came out of that Hope Chapel lineage, so to speak. And why isn't my name on? He said, well, you didn't answer the email. So more people started pouring in with more information, and that number kept growing and growing and growing. And then they find out that somebody was a worship leader who went somewhere else in the South and planted some churches. Somebody went over to Africa, and just through that one guy downstream of Hope Chapel, Hermosa Beach, is 400 churches. And I got to tell you, I'm sitting here listening to Ralph explain this, and he's self-effacing. He's not trying to take any credit for himself. This is what God is doing, and it's just amazing. He didn't even keep track of it. But when he got a little bit of a picture of the total, it was unbelievable. And we'll never know how many churches total, because you have this multiplication factor, right? You got one that sent out four, that each of those sent out five, and each of those sent out a couple more, and it's herky-jerky as you go down the line, but you can see the metric, the multiplication, and that's the way it works. That's the master plan of evangelism, to cite the title of a book by Robert Coleman that looked at the way Jesus did it. It's something that Ralph internalized through all that exposure, imbibing of the book of Acts, day after day after day after day. It became part of his DNA, and it became part of the DNA of his pastoral staff that he discipled with this idea, and it became part of my DNA. And in fact, stand to reason. Just think of this, that we didn't come up on that list because we're not a church. They were looking at the churches that were planted. Stand to reason is an organization. I think we're the only 501c3 parachurch organization, whatever, that was sent out by Hope Chapel Hermosa Beach. But you guys know, after 28 years plus now, the kind of impact that Stand to Reason has had in your life and the lives of other people. And they call in and say it. And I'm not trying to ring my bell. I'm just trying to let you know that here's a whole nother universe of impact downstream from Ralph Moore, that what didn't even show up on the tally. So what's my point? My point is that here's one guy that used his gifts in a faithful, biblical way. He wasn't hanging on to power. He was willing to let go of not only power, but people. He was willing to let people expand and stretch their wings, even people like me, on the stage leading worship, and I forget the words to the song. Literally, there I was. And poor Doris has got her fingers hovering over the keys, waiting for me to find the word before she can hit the keys. That's me on the stage. But nevertheless, it gave me an opportunity to grow, and lots of other people too. And then he wasn't willing to hang on to us. He was letting us go. This is why we let Scott Klusendorf go to start Life Training Institute, and Stephen Wagner to go with Justice for All, and J. Warner Wallace with Cold Case Christianity, and Brett Kunkel with Maven. Now, Brett was hard to let go. He's a talent. Many of you loved Brett and benefited from what he did. The whole strategy we now call reality used to be Rethink. That's Brett's baby. But when we let Brett go, and with our blessing, and he started Maven, now he's doing more than he ever could have done under us, I'm convinced. But and did we suffer? No. God took care of us. You cast your bread upon the water, and it will come back to you. And that's what Ralph Moore instilled in me, and that's what I am trying to live out in the life of Stand to Reason. Pass it on. Entrust it to others, let them go out in the power of the Spirit and do their thing for the Lord and for the kingdom. I wanted to pass another thing on to you, too, that last night I came back to South Bay from where I live in Conejo Valley, about an hour or so away. It took me longer to drive because there was a thunderstorm and there's a lot of traffic. Incidentally, that doesn't happen here in Southern California. Thunderstorms? It's like, what a strange bird, right? Everybody's nodding their head here on the other side of the glass. Thunder and lightning, okay, and rain. That's a weird bird, even now. It's a little early in the season. Nevertheless, I came back to meet with some of these friends that, like the Englerts and some others, and one of the things that they had just been the night before, Sunday evening, at the Harvest Crusade. And apparently, I wasn't there, but I saw some pictures. This is the Greg Laurie's Enterprise that is held at the Angel, is it Angel Stadium? Yeah. It's huge, and it was filled to the brim, overflowing with people. It was crazy. And there were so many people that were coming down. He had to keep extending the altar call 5 minutes, then another 5 minutes. And this isn't like, you know, when your pastor does that. I'm waiting for the hands of people who want to become a Christian. Nobody's sticking their hands up. We'll wait another 5 minutes until somebody sticks their hand up. No, these were people that were coming down and coming down and coming down and coming down. They just had to wait for them all to come down. I don't know what the numbers were, but there were a lot of people. Thousands, probably. And the reason I bring this up is because, and I talked about this with my friends last night, there is a macro perspective and there's a micro perspective. And the question is, what is going on? What is happening in our culture? Are people open to the gospel or not? And it's standard reason we look at the macro. Principally, we're looking at the big picture. We're looking at the cultural, the spirit of the age, as it were. We're looking at the cultural moves and the ethic of the culture and dealing with the world of ideas. And we see these things mounting up against us that ideologically are hostile to Christianity. We're speaking out against it and training you to deal with these things when you run into them in the culture and everything. That's the macro. That's our world, largely. But the micro is all these individual people that are trusting the Lord. And not just at Harvest Crusades. We have people that I knew 30 years, 40 years ago at Hope Chapel that are still there, that are going on the weekends, in the evenings, out onto the piers, sharing Christ one-on-one and seeing massive numbers of people trust Christ. Just like in the Jesus movement. That's all going on. And so this is something we're not always have visibility of. I'm fighting a different kind of battle. But it's all to say that there is something God is doing, and he's always doing according to his plan and according to his purpose. And my job is that, oh, people are trusting Christ over in Hermosa Pier on Friday nights. That mean I go out there? No, that's not my lane. It's not my gift. It's not what I do. I'm not micro. I'm macro. It's just that's where God has me. That's where my boots hit the ground. Okay. But others are doing other things. And every once in a while we get a glimpse of this, what God has been accomplishing in the lives of people. And it's awesome. It is reason to get excited. It's reason to take hope. It isn't just, well, I know how the book of Revelations ends. We win in the end, but it gets really tough. Well, it's going to be tough, and I think it's going to be tougher for us in this country. But that doesn't mean that masses of people are not going to trust Christ, become Christians, because of the pressure of the macro. No, and sometimes the pressure of the macro, what it looks like, the big picture, so bad that in the micro, the individuals are crying out for hope, crying out for forgiveness, crying out for belonging. And that's happening too. I don't know how much. I just get these smaller pictures or the big one. Some of you were at the crusade and know what I'm talking about. But the key is, and this is what, you know, I talked about with my team today. Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to keep doing what we do, and we're going to do it faithfully, as unto the Lord. And we are going to reproduce ourselves in other people. We're going to pass it on. We're going to pass that baton. And then when we pass it, they're going to take that baton. They're going to pass that baton. And in different ways, people are going to do this. But that is how the kingdom goes forward. We plant. Someone else waters. God causes the increase. Anyway, it's so great to see our friends. after all these years. I was amazed at how many people I still recognized, and I still remembered their names. Whoa. You know me, right? That's a miracle in itself. Incidentally, and I have this on my schedule, but it hadn't registered with me until somebody said it yesterday, there at Hope Chapel Hermosa Beach, 2420 Pacific Coast Highway, is I'm actually going to be teaching there on the weekend. And I'm going to be doing an event in a revived program, the program that I was responsible for when I was on staff there, that Craig Englert was responsible for when he was on staff there before he went to Maui and planted his church, Hope Chapel Kihei. And this is called Hope Chapel Ministry Institute. And so I'm kicking off a series of talks on Sunday night from 6 until 8 at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. If you're here in Southern California, and especially the Los Angeles Bay Area, or South Bay is what they call it, would like to come, I'd love to have you. I very rarely do anything in the South Bay, and especially at my old home church. And it was sweet when I saw Zach Nazarian. He gave me a big hug and he said, "Welcome home." And that's right, this was my home for 25 years. And I'm glad to be able to teach there on Sunday night coming up this weekend from 6 until 8 p.m. So it'll be Sunday evening. And I'll be teaching, I think, on tactics, but kicking off a series that they're doing at Hope Chapel Ministry Institute. Hope to see you there anyway. So I'll probably have more stories to tell then, but just wanted to bring you up to date on that and give you a little taste of the wonderful impact of Ralph Moore in so many lives, including mine and including yours indirectly, because this whole enterprise is downstream from his efforts, and also have you take courage from it, because God can take you wherever you're at if you're going to be faithful and step out in faith and trust and use your gifts and be willing to let power go and be willing to give stuff away. God will prosper that in ways you had no idea. All right? Let's take a break. We got some calls coming up. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Have you seen our brand new website? Stop by str.org and enjoy a fresh, clean layout with all the same great content. The new Stand to Reason website was designed with you in mind. It has an easier-than-ever navigation and a crisp, simple layout so you can find all the sound analysis and careful commentary that you've come to expect from us. Browse new features that make finding your favorite resources easier than ever. As always, it's our goal to equip you, our fellow Christians, with the confidence, clear thinking, and courage you need for every encounter you have as a Christian ambassador. Our new website is just one way we're fulfilling that goal, allowing you to access the resources you need in a new and improved way. So visit str.org and keep coming back to discover new podcasts, articles, and videos each and every day.
Did you know Stand to Reason has a YouTube channel? We release a new video each Monday on the topics you care about. Through short, engaging videos, our speakers train you on tactics, offer apologetics tips, answer common theology questions, and address big issues in the world today. Join tens of thousands of other subscribers so you can stay up to date when we release a new video. Just go to youtube.com and search STR Videos, all one word, and hit the subscribe button. That's STR Videos. Take advantage of this free resource to help you stay informed, encouraged, and equipped as you share your worldview with others.
Back at you here, Greg Kokel, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do on my show, this show, our show, every week, Tuesdays from 4 until 6 p.m. Los Angeles time. That's queuing you in, and when to call if you'd like to, 855-243-9975. Okay, let's go to the phones, and okay, I'm being really careful with my fingers here so I don't make a mistake. This would be Katie, is that right?
Yes, that's me.
Hi, Katie in Las Vegas.
Hello. Welcome. Thank you so much for taking my call today.
Yes, ma'am.
So I wanted to ask you real quick. I spoke to you before and you gave me some great information about Mormon beliefs, and mm-hmm. I've been talking to them with that. And one of the things that has come up is that they talk about their three levels of glory or their three levels of heaven, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to them about the different verses in the Bible that tell us that when we're done here, we have not works that are going to get us into heaven, but we are have salvation through Jesus that's going to get us into the presence of God.
Correct.
And they say, well, that's true, but Jesus gets us into heaven, period. Then our works get us our different levels of glory.
Mm-hmm.
And in looking in the Bible and reading all the stuff about the rewards that we're going to get into heaven, I'm not saying the Mormons are right, but I'm trying to figure out, like, maybe did they come up with this based on a real thing in the Bible? Are we going to have different levels of glory like that? And maybe could they have gotten that idea from there?
Well, I don't know the history of Mormonism and how they came up, with these different things. Generally, what you have, often what you have is you have some foreign idea to the broader Christian characterization of things like heaven that is introduced as a result of a revelation given to somebody in that group. And
right.
Then they're looking for Bible verses that seem to dovetail with that notion, and then they could say, see, the Bible teaches what my prophet is teaching.
Exactly.
Well, when you take the teaching or the verse that they're making reference to in isolation, in its context, and you look at it, then you realize that there's usually something else going on that is being communicated by the author than what the so-called prophet of this other group has in mind when he's talking about that. So it's kind of a cherry-picking of verses to support the view of a prophet when the verses taken in context don't make that actual point. So this may be the case here. The fact that there are different, I don't know if levels is the right word. I mean, different people might use different language to describe it, and this is where we might run into a little bit of confusion. There are going to be rewards in heaven, and not everyone is going to have exactly the same, in a certain sense, status.
Right.
Okay? But there's nothing. There are greater rewards, and there are greater punishments on both sides of the equation. So Jesus said that Capernaum, for example, is going to have the people in Capernaum who reject Christ are going to have a greater judgment than even Sodom and Gomorrah because there's Jesus there and they're not even receiving Jesus. So there is a greater, there are different levels of punishment based on different levels of rejection, understanding, and evil, greater sins, lesser sins. And in heaven, there are different levels too. Now, but that doesn't mean when we see like greater punishment that there's going to be like upper hell, medium hell, and lower hell. And then you have like a deeper, deeper, deeper place in hell kind of thing. You know, people say there's got a deep place in hell for that person. You know, it isn't like that. We are thinking in spatial terms. But that isn't it. All the scripture indicates is that there is going to be more punishment or less punishment. That's hell. When it comes to heaven, you have more. There are greater rewards or a great. There's advantages to godliness, you know, because godliness we experience in this life holds a promise also for the life to come. And so we have different indicators. We have a better resurrection, it says in the book of Hebrews chapter 11. So there is no question that there are grades in a certain sense, but that doesn't mean that there are, heaven is three-tiered and there are three different kinds of heaven. That's the Mormon doctrine. And that you're going to end up in different places. I actually don't think it's the case. And here's where Amy is much more of she's more knowledgeable about this than I am. But the idea that, okay, Jesus gets you into heaven, so faith in Jesus gets you into heaven, all works do is they place you in different levels of heaven.
Right.
I don't know about that, but I mean, my sense is that that is the Mormon view. Okay.
Yes, it is.
So the question is, but there's more difficult. There's other issues like being married in the temple is what gets you in the highest heaven, right?
Right.
Okay. So these are details or refinements that are Mormon, but they are not biblical. Okay.
Agree.
So the Mormons are going to say this is the way that thing plays out. All right. But when you have these things playing out in this way, there are more details that are added that are germane to an entirely different view of God and salvation and heaven and hell than the Christian view. So the implication seems to be, at least at first blush, that this is just a little, we're basically like you in this regard, and we just have a more refined understanding of how that works.
Exactly.
But when you look at their refined understanding, it is a piece of a larger enterprise that bears no similarity to biblical Christianity.
And actually goes against it. That's a very good point, because it's the little pieces that I'm like, yeah, that's actually kind of a good point. I didn't think of it that way. But then when you follow it through, like you said, with the marriage that they have to have in the temple to get to the top level, it kind of it deflates the whole thing, because the rest of it, the doctrine that has to go with it, then goes against the Bible.
Well, it's not only that, water baptism is efficacious in their view, and this is why they are baptizing their past generations. They are trying to do a physical act to get somebody else into heaven. That person did not believe in Jesus. How are they getting into heaven if belief in Jesus determines that? No, it's baptism that's going to get them into heaven, even if they never believed in Jesus. And that's why they're baptizing for the dead. And they're grabbing this little piece out of 1 Corinthians 15 in order to justify this practice, when in fact this bears no resemblance to anything in the New Testament pertaining to salvation. If they isolate this piece about baptism for the dead, and then they invest it with their own meaning in a way that that creates a system that's completely different than the system that Jesus and the apostles have passed on to us, okay? And so it's now a whole different kind of religion. I'm trying to think of an example that would resonate with them, where you can have two different worldviews, but that may overlap at one particular point. Let's just say. Oh well, here's one. Bernard Nathanson was one of the founders of the Abortion Rights Action League. Okay, they have a different name now, but he was one of the most prominent and prolific abortionists in New York City. He was an atheist, but he became a pro-lifer while still an atheist, based on his reflections on the nature of abortion and taking innocent human life.
Don't get up every time.
Pardon me?
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to hit the button there. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Were you chastising one of your children there or something? Did I miss that? Okay.
Yes. Sorry.
Okay.
She's supposed to be doing homework.
Here, I did my homework, Mom.
Sorry
I'm
about
talking
that.
To, no, okay. That's all right. So Bernard Nathanson becomes a pro-lifer, though he's still an atheist. So now here I am a pro-lifer who's a theistic pro-lifer. He is a pro-lifer who's an atheistic pro-lifer. We share the pro-life view. That doesn't mean we share a worldview.
Right.
We just share that particular element, all right? Now, it's worse than that regarding, I'm doing an analogy with Mormonism, because the view that we share, which is that there, when you die and go to heaven, there's a disparity of, in a certain sense, rewards. It doesn't, my understanding of the way the Bible teaches it, it doesn't look anything like their description. But at least with Bernard Nathanson and me, we both believe that abortion's wrong for the same reasons. It's exactly the same view, even though we have different worldviews. But in this case, the overlap isn't even the same. It isn't just the same. And when you look at Mormonism and virtually every other detail, and I know this because I wrote a piece a number of years ago, and you can find it on our website, and I think the title was, Is Mormonism a Christian Denomination, or something to that effect? I wasn't asking whether it was true or not. I was whose views were true. I was just asking, is it fair to say that Mormonism is a subset of Christianity? And the answer is no, for a couple of reasons. One is because their founder, said that all the other denominations of Christianity are abominations before God, and this is why you need the Latter-day Saints to restore the lost gospel. So by his assessments, there's no kinship. This is different. But when you look at LDS beliefs, which is the closest thing they have to a systematic theology, I bought it from them, from Deseret Press, and use it as my source material. When you look at all the basic things that are foundational to Christianity, like Nicene, Council of Nicaea, Christology, and theology and stuff like that, they explicitly reject that notion. And all kinds of other things. Their God is a different God. Their Jesus is a different Jesus. Their spirit is a different spirit. Their gospel is a different gospel. Now, I'm not saying they're right or wrong at this point. I'm just simply saying they're different. That's all I'm saying right now. I think they are wrong.
Right.
But the point I'm making is they're not the same. They're totally different worldviews. And there's almost no actual theological overlap. So if they want to make the case that you guys have, like, rewards in heaven, various degrees of heaven, kind of, which is true, although I'm not sure what that actually looks like, but there's a sense that you're, and we have varying degrees in heaven, kind of, therefore our view is just as true as your view because we agree on this. Well, we only agree in very, very broad formal principle here, that there are going to be differences for people who go to heaven, all right? That's it. The way the differences are cashed out in Mormonism are completely unique to the biblical Christianity, you know? And so there's no reason to think that the Bible somehow supports that view. So I think in this particular thing, they are straining at a gnat, all right? They say believing in Jesus is what gets us into heaven. So is it faith in Christ alone? You know, Jesus alone, you know, the solus, you know, faith alone, Christ alone, whatever.
Right.
What are the solas?
Saved by faith alone in Christ alone.
Yeah.
By grace alone.
By grace alone. Right. Thank you.
Well, and they keep saying, their answer to that keeps going to, well, yes, we believe we're saved by grace too, into immortal life. Mm-hmm. But once you get immortal life, then your works determine what level of heaven you get. And those works, like you said, included the temple rituals and all of that mm-hmm. to the different levels of heaven. And you're absolutely right with that.
What's interesting to me is that, and I talk about this in the article, you might want to read the article, because I am very, very fair with their texts. I use all of their own material. It's very clear, for example, that they are polytheistic. And what they do is they say, we believe that not the triune God, but the Godhead, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who are each God, and each are individual as you and I are. Okay, so there's three distinct gods. They say, we believe in three distinct gods, but we are not polytheistic. Of course, this is intellectually dishonest, because you can't say there are three individual gods, Father, Son, and Spirit, and not say at the same, and deny you're polytheistic, because poly means more than one, and theist means God. They identify three gods, that's poly. Theism. That's what the words mean.
Yep.
Okay, and there's nothing clearer in the Bible from the beginning to the end but that there's only one God. And that is one God over everything, not just one God for our world, but other worlds have other gods. All right, that's Mormonism. That's not biblical Christianity.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, I'm glad that you keep at it here, and of course a big issue too. And to me, when I look at groups like this, this is what I focus on. Where there's actually three issues. So and this prevents me from getting off into tangential issues that aren't necessarily going to be that helpful. And one of those issues is, what do I need? Who is Jesus and God? The nature of Jesus and God. Okay, that question. What do I need to do? What must I do to be saved? That's another question. Okay. And then the nature of authority. And it's interesting that in all these groups, you're going to have different answers to those three questions than classical Christianity. And especially the nature of authority, for them, the nature of authority, who is the authority? Well, the Bible's the authority, but there's also this other stuff. And
right.
whenever you have this other stuff, like the Doctrine of Covenants and the Pearl of Great Price and the Book of Mormon, as being additional things, what ends up happening is the Bible gets tossed in the back seat. In the front seat, driving doctrine and theology for these groups are their special revelation. And when their special revelation seems to disagree with the Bible, well, they're just dismissive of it. You know?
Yes, exactly.
It's their stuff that really is the most important thing. And I mean, that's the whole deal. Latter-day Saints, so they got this new thing. But then, what must I do to be saved? And that's another thing you got to test out and see. Does it? Oh, they can make noise about salvation by grace, but is that the way it works out? I honestly now, Amy gave the nod that you got it right. That they're saved by grace. But then it just depends on the level of heaven that you end up in that is determined by your works. So
right.
So your total enterprise, one aspect of salvation is by grace, but not the other aspect. I just wonder if that's, I don't know, in practice, if it really plays out that way in people's lives. If they, I just have a book in the other room that was somebody sent me, former Mormon now, after 40 years, been discovered the grace of God. And this is the message I hear time and time again from people coming out of the Mormon church, is that the powerful transformative element for them was discovering the grace of God, which grace was not there in the Mormon church in the way that the New Testament teaches it. And this is what was liberating for them.
Right.
The grace of God.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the part that I keep trying to reach with these folks that I care so much about, is I know that they believe that they have the same grace that I believe in,
mm-hmm.
but I know it's not the same.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to convince them of it, we keep coming to these things where, oh, well, yes, I believe in grace, but then you have to, it's even in their own prophet's words where it says in their scriptures, we believe in grace after all we can do. Well, have you done all you can do? Is
mm-hmm.
So if the grace only comes after all you can do,
mm-hmm.
and you admit that you're a fallen, sinful person who can't always do all you can do, then the grace is never going to come to you, right?
You don't satisfy the requirement. That's an interesting point, because you haven't done all you could do. So
right.
Notice how on that take, and again, I don't know how accurate that is of broader Mormon theology, but on that take, it is you work as hard as you can. And when you're exhausted and done as much as you could do, then grace picks up from there.
Right.
Right? This is backwards.
But even then, how do you know if you have done all you can do?
Well, I'll tell you what, we all know we haven't done all that we can do. And a couple of weeks ago, it was last week when I was talking about my own spiritual birthday and the impact of grace in my life, and I cited some passages. And I didn't cite this one from Romans 4, but this one stands out so significantly for me. And that is because of the kind of contrast. And so think about these words of Paul in contrast to your Mormon friends or relatives approach, you know, do all you can do, and then grace kicks in after that. But for him who does not work, but believes in God who justifies the ungodly, that doesn't sound like doing all you can do, to him,
right.
to him it is reckoned as righteous. And it's in that phrase is in contrast to the one that comes before it when he says to the person who works, then what he's given is what is due him. It's a wage.
Exactly.
All right? And that's what they're saying. Do all you can do. Well, then God owes me, doesn't he? He owes me the grace at the end to pick up where I left off because I've done all I could do. I've earned that. But Paul argues directly against that in Romans chapter 4.
Yes.
For him who does not work, but believes in a God who justifies the ungodly, to him it is reckoned as righteousness. So that's Pauline theology, and he's just painting a very, very stark picture, dramatic picture to be clear for him who does not work, but believes. Contrast, works, faith. If it's by works, it's not by faith. If it's by faith, it's not by works. It's not by both. And they exactly. have it kind of both.
And their point on, when I bring that exact verse up, their point is, yes, absolutely, we agree that it's by faith, that it's not by works, and that our wages for our works is our level in heaven. Like, we believe, and so we get immortal life, and then our wages is our level in heaven.
Yeah. The harder part about that, and I'm in a certain sense in this conversation, I'm sympathetic to their point, because, if you just, in a certain sense, bypass the level in heaven kind of language, because that seems to fit in their eschatology, you know, these three levels. But there is a sense in which something like that seems to be going on, but it's plugged into a different structure
right.
than they're using it for. And this is why I brought up Bernard Nathanson. Because his whole structure as an atheist is very different than our whole structure as theists, which even though we share a moral view about something important, it turns out that the moral view he shared with us was inconsistent with his worldview. It didn't really fit into his worldview, but it made common moral sense to him. What we're doing is wrong.
Right.
But it fits into our worldview. So there's a coherence with our worldview. Now, just as a point of information, Bernard Nathanson eventually became a Christian. But first he became a pro-lifer, and then he became a Christian. All right?
So, interesting how that works.
Yeah, and I think he became a Roman Catholic, is what I recall. But I'm just using this as an illustration. They may be able to say certain things which, taken in isolation, have a kinship to some of our views, all right? And they would look at passages, see, this passage teaches that. Well, insofar as the passage teaches that, then there is a verse that seems to be in somewhat in a line with a claim that you're making. But what you don't realize is the way you use this concept is to plug it into an entirely different system than the New Testament system. Because in the New Testament system, Jesus is not the spirit brother of Lucifer. He isn't one that's gone before us and attained godhood so we can do like him. He is the God who made everything that ever was made. And this is very clear from John chapter 1, verse 3. And
yep.
the Word became flesh, dwelt among us. I'm sorry, that's 14. But and all things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. Okay? So he's the uncreated creator. He's the guy that was there at the very beginning, Genesis 1:1. That's this the Word, same one. That's the Jesus we're talking about. We are not talking about the spirit brother of Lucifer. We're not talking about somebody who's just like us, only he's older and he's gone further and than we have, and we hope to follow him. It's not, there's a different, it's not even orders of magnitude. We're talking about entirely different kinds of things. God, the Creator, coming
exactly.
to Earth. And so, I'm glad that you're hanging in there, and you sound still pretty energetic, and you're engaging them. And I am not the best person to, in a certain sense, direct you. In these, I mean, you're doing fine, all right, and I don't have all the theological stuff. What I do know is classical Christianity, and I
yeah.
have some ideas about how their views diverge. By the way, you might ask them, how is it that marriage on earth and having your marriage accomplished, sealed in a particular way, all right, has ramifications in heaven for eternal marriage, when Jesus himself said, in heaven there is no marriage or given in marriage, but rather we're like the angels?
I just had that conversation with somebody the other night, and their answer is that there is no marriage that is the earthly marriage, the kind that we do here on earth, but the kind that they do in temples is the kind that God allows in heaven.
Okay, well, see, it's too bad that Jesus didn't know that.
Right.
You know, this is, Okay, I can see how frustrating it is. It's,
it is.
What
it
they have...
That's why I've come to you and like six other online folks, because I'm like, I got to get somebody else's words in this, because I'm running in circles.
But think about this, though. What's happened? What you have here is a way of kind of getting around the plain sense of that we can explain that. Okay, just because you have an explanation doesn't mean that your explanation accurately or soundly or legitimately comports with the text itself.
Right.
When I read these passages, I'm not thinking, well, Jesus is just talking about marriage in this life, not marriage in the next life, all right? That there's a certain earth. He's talking about marriage, period. He makes no distinctions.
Right.
And what they're doing is inventing a whole category that Jesus didn't have in mind. And incidentally, the marriage that they do in the temple is a marriage on earth.
Yes.
Now, they can change the language and call it a heavenly marriage, but that doesn't change the teaching of Jesus on the issue because they've changed the vocabulary.
Right. And that's when they go back to their, well, many plain and precious truths were lost from the Bible and our prophet restored them, and that's why it's true.
Okay, well, and why would you say they were lost from the Bible? See, this is where the second step of the Columbo tactic comes in. Okay,
yeah.
I can explain that. They were lost. Really? And what is your evidence that they were lost?
What makes you think that? Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
How did you come to that conclusion? Right, why would you think that that's... I get it. Okay, you can say that about every single thing that differs from biblical Christianity. But
right.
How do you know the difference between the real thing and some make-me-up of Joseph Smith or one of the prophets? You don't. Unless you're simply saying, I've got the Holy Spirit witness. And see, now the authority is invested in them personally because they've got the Holy Spirit bearing testimony to the truth of it. And now it's totally subjective.
Yep.
Yeah, so anyway.
Which is really hard to get past.
Yeah, it is. I have an idea about how to do that, but we're out of time here right now.
I'm
glad to take your call for the bulk of the rest of the show, because this is important, and you're doing the hard footwork and the heavy lifting with your friends. So keep it up, okay?
I will. Thank you,
Katie,
so much.
In Las Vegas, and we will we'll talk to you again, okay?
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, that's it for the show, friends. Thank you. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.